Got questions. Sometimes we ask questions because to know the answer would be interesting or helpful. How are the Spurs doing? What's the weather going to be like tomorrow? Same as today. What's for dinner? How can I get to your house? And these are category one questions. But there's a whole different category of questions that are not just for interest's sake. There's an urgency about them. It's not usually asked academically. Can you tell me how to get to the emergency room? There's usually a point to that question. And you can probably think of your own list of life and death, got to be answered now kinds of questions. There's a third category of questions that are just as critical as the second category, but they're not quite so time sensitive. I'm thinking about the questions that we think about when we're lying awake in bed late at night, or maybe these are the questions that actually keep us awake late at night. These are the questions we ask ourselves when we're all alone. Nobody's around, maybe it's a long road trip. These are the questions about life, the world and our place in it, injustice, suffering, right and wrong, God. These are, unfortunately, precisely the questions we often don't get around to addressing in life. We're so busy. There's so much going on. There's meals to fix and work to be done and relationships to be nurtured and kids to raise and, you know, on and on and on. And these questions are important, but rarely do they rise to the level of emergency room stuff. You can put them off. We can deal with that later, those third category kinds of questions. But if these questions are put off long enough, and if they are left unaddressed and are not dealt with seriously, they eventually leave a gaping hole in our souls. If we don't address or deal with these questions, these big-ticket items, we are ill-equipped to lead the kinds of confident, joy-filled, hopeful lives we envision living. So, beginning today, and for the next several Sundays, we're going to give ourselves on Sunday mornings to consideration of these big-ticket items. And we're going to consider together questions like, why is there evil in the world? God is all good. Why does evil exist? Why do good things happen? That's the question nobody ever asks. Why do bad things happen to good people? Is the Bible reliable? It's a very old book. Is it something you can trust? Are miracles possible? Isn't religion just a psychological crutch for emotionally weak people and unstable people? If Christianity is true, why are there so many hypocrites in the church? Those kinds of questions. We're going to begin today with one particular question, one particular big-ticket question. It's probably the granddaddy of them all. It's the one thoughtful people have been asking since the beginning of time. It's the question that you've probably reflected on in reflective moments. I'm sure you've thought about this. It's the God question. Specifically, is He? Does God exist? Now, this is going to be a very, very, very different message from the kinds of messages I usually bring. Because I am scarcely going to reference the Bible. Now, that's not because I'm not all about the Bible. I really like the Bible a lot. I love the Bible, but the Bible rarely ever addresses itself to the issue of does God exist. It assumes His existence from beginning to end, but it doesn't argue for the existence of God. This is going to be more of a talk. This is going to be kind of a logical, somewhat philosophical, even touching on science kinds of discussion about does God exist? And it's kind of laughable because I'm going to try to address in 25 or 30 minutes the topic of does God exist? And we could spend a year talking about this. But here we go. Ready? Okay. To the question, does God exist? You could give any one of about three answers. You could say no. You could say maybe. You could say yes. So I'm going to take them one at a time. If you say no to the question, does God exist, that puts you squarely in the camp of atheism. The word atheism, the meaning is probably pretty transparently clear what it means, but Webster helps us. It is the doctrine or belief that there is no God. Okay, and an atheist is a person who believes that there is no God. And atheism is riding the crest of a wave of popularity in these days. In this first decade of the third millennium, atheism is very, very popular. One of the leading spokesmen for atheism is a man named Richard Dawkins, Sir Richard Dawkins from Great Britain. He is an Oxford professor. He's the author of many books. One of the books he's written is one that I've recently become familiar with called The God Delusion. Different cover, but same book, The God Delusion. Dawkins writes in his books, in fact, in 2005, Dawkins was called by Discover magazine Darwin's Rottweiler because of his fierce defense of atheistic evolution. Prospect magazine voted him among the top three public intellectuals in the world. This guy's bright. He uses his intellect to defend the idea that religion generally and belief in God generally is based on faulty logic and results in some really, really bad things. He criticizes and critiques God in all forms in which you might find him in the world today. He believes that belief in God is responsible for war, bigotry, the abuse of children, and all kinds of other evils. Believes the world would be a better place without religion and God. In his introduction to the God Delusion, he says this. He asks his readers to imagine a world like John Lennon of the Beatles without religion, and then starts to catalog all kinds of atrocities he attributes to religion. Everything from the 9/11 attacks to the Taliban and Al-Qaeda to Israeli-Palestinian war and Serb-Croat massacres. And then he ends with, quote, shiny-suited, bouffant-haired televangelists fleecing gullible people of their money. And in the introduction to this book, he expresses hopes. If this book works as I intend, religious readers who open it up will be atheists when they put it down. He's one of the leading lights of the atheist movement, but he's not the only light. He's not the only voice. There's another man named Christopher Hitchens. Christopher Hitchens is a brilliant political analyst, especially astute when it comes to the politics of the Middle East and the Balkans. He has engaged in an online conversation in Christianity Today with Douglas Wilson, where they were debating the question, is Christianity good for the world? Hitchens argues Christianity is not good for the world. In fact, the book that he wrote, one of the many books he wrote, God is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. There are lots and lots of other books that are being written these days about atheism, in favor of atheism. Michael Martin and Ricky Monnier have edited the book called The Impossibility of God. Russ Kirk edited another book. He titled Everything You Know About God is Wrong. Their titles are very clear. Some other books that I could mention, but it is very clear that in this day and age, atheism is alive and well. And it's represented by some very bright people. But if Richard Dawkins can say bluntly in the introduction to The God Delusion that he wants readers to put the book down having become atheists, I will be just as blunt this morning to say that by the end of our time together, I hope that everyone here will be able to say that there is indeed compelling reasonableness for the belief in God. That's where I want to go. I don't know what your own history with atheism is, but I have a little bit of experience with atheism myself. Maybe you've known people. Perhaps that's part of your journey. Maybe that's where you are right now. Atheism is a part of my own personal story. I was raised in a family where our family went to church on a very regular basis, but the church that we attended didn't take the Bible seriously, didn't really even talk about God that much. Our church was the church where you really focused on being nice. Just oozed niceness. And it was all about doing good and being the best you can, but didn't talk much about God. And I grew up in that church Once I became a teen, I began to have questions about God. Most teens do. And I found these questions not being addressed in the church I attended. So as a teenager, as a young teenager, in fact, I came to the conclusion that if God is not very much a part of church, there must not be very much to this whole God thing. And I became a professed atheist. Now, I'm not going to pretend for one moment that my atheism was the kind of rationally developed, philosophically astute atheism espoused by an intellect like Richard Dawkins. But I did believe, for a period of years, that I was alone in the universe and that God was not. And that's atheism. Atheism claims that God does not exist. And to those who would say there is no God, I would offer a caution. Suppose, just imagine a circle, a very large circle like that one, and within that circle is contained all the knowledge that is possible to have in the universe. Now, imagine another circle within that circle, and that's probably very generous, but that circle would represent all of your knowledge. Obviously, there's lots of knowledge available out there in the universe that you and I don't have. So there is, outside the circle of your knowledge, at least the possibility that God exists somewhere out there. What makes atheism difficult to swallow is the absoluteness with which we must state the position. There is no God. And there are vast worlds of reality that all of us have no access to. So it seems to me unreasonable to be able to say that any of us can say there is no God. We don't know enough. The atheist has the same problem that anybody has who tries to prove a negative, try to prove that something doesn't exist. If I believe, and I do happen to believe, that there are no pink polka-dotted green striped cats, what I would have to do to prove that is to round up all the cats there are, and the possibility would still exist that there is one green-striped, pink, polka-dotted cat out there that I just have missed. It's almost impossible to prove a negative. And it is impossible to prove, to be certain, that God is not out there somewhere in the universe outside of our knowledge and our experience. But if the atheist is right, if the atheist is right and there is no God, then we should take a minute or two and just consider what the universe would look like if there is no God. If there's no God out there. All of our hearts cry for meaning. We long to believe, we hunger to believe that we have some place, some significant place in the grand scheme of things. And meaning and purpose is the one thing that is absolutely denied us in a universe where there is no God. This world is all there is. Without God, there's no ultimate mooring for morality. All of our mores and all of our moral standards are built on sandcast. They're built on shifting sand if there is no God beneath them. Our values, our aspirations are rendered meaningless with no God. In fact, the Bible even says that not only is there no absolute morality, it says that one of the reasons some people choose atheism is so that there's no ultimate accountability. Without God, Shakespeare's Macbeth has it right. Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage, and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. Now, to my way of thinking, I was an atheist at a certain point in my life. I turned from atheism to theism, and I'd be happy to share that story with anybody who would like to listen to it. It's a great story. To my way of thinking, atheism is a very unpleasant philosophical position. But the fact that it strikes me as distressing is no reason to dismiss it. There are all kinds of things in the world that I find personally distressing. I don't like paying taxes, but it's a reality. I don't like the presence of cancer and AIDS and war. But the fact that I don't like those things doesn't mean that I can dismiss them. Depending on your perspective, atheism may or may not be distressing. It may be pleasant. It may be what you are drawn to. But your preference is irrelevant to the reality of the situation. Beliefs don't determine reality. It is possible that everybody in the world might believe in God and he doesn't exist. Everybody might be wrong. And it's just as possible that everybody might deny him and he still exists. Again, beliefs don't determine reality. But one thing we can say is that whether you're Richard Dawkins or any of us here today, we don't have enough information to say categorically there is no God. So if we can't say no to the question, that leaves us with the second option, okay, maybe. And the word we use to describe the maybe position is agnosticism. There's atheism, which says no, and agnosticism says maybe. But agnosticism is even more emotionally unsatisfying than atheism. Because it leaves us with not knowing and actually saying you can't know. Well, I think there's something you can know. I think it is possible to look for evidence. And what a thinking person does, what a thinking man or a woman or a young person does who wants to explore the question, the ultimate God question, is they look for evidence that points to the existence or not of God. And notice I said evidence, not proof. When we think of proof, we're usually thinking of mathematical or scientific certainty. Hard science like biology and chemistry looks for proofs. But there are all kinds of knowledge besides scientific knowledge. There is historical knowledge. Scientific knowledge is based on controlled, repeatable experiments. Historical knowledge is, by definition, not dependent, and you can't even access repeatable experiments, obviously. There's legal knowledge. You know, the verdicts rendered in a court of law are not rendered on the basis of scientific evidence. They're rendered on the basis of evidence, but not scientific proof. In a civil case, it's the preponderance of evidence. In a criminal case, it's the level is higher. It's beyond a reasonable doubt. So when we investigate the possibility of the existence of God, we're not looking for scientific proof. If God exists, he's certainly not going to submit himself to repeatable controlled experiments. We're looking for evidence that would convince a reasonable person. And yes, this is where faith will come in. But notice, this is not faith in spite of evidence, or this is not faith against evidence, it's faith based on evidence. Belief in God is not a leap into the dark of ignorance. Belief in God is a step into the light based on evidence. And if, after examination, we discover there's not enough evidence, it'll be wise to not believe. So, where do we look for evidence of the existence of God? Where might we look? Well, philosophers have said for thousands of years that the biggest philosophical question out there is this: why does anything exist? We've got this big universe here. We've got stars and galaxy and planets and people and animals and all kinds of things. Why does it exist? How did it come about? And I want to take the question, how do we have anything here, with the three possible answers, and just kind of examine them for a couple of minutes. One possibility is that the universe has always existed. And if the universe is eternal, if the universe has always existed, then you don't need God. God is unnecessary to an eternal universe. The universe has just always been around. And until relatively recently, the idea of an eternal universe has found favor with a lot of scientists. But somewhere in the early 20th century, that theory that matter is eternal began to fall out of favor. And it's because of the discovery that the universe is expanding. Where discoveries made in the 1920s and 30s about the expanding universe, which resulted in the theory we refer to as the Big Bang Theory. And that's simply the idea that at a certain finite point in time, the universe began and is expanding outward. And then since the 1990s, there's been all kinds of explosions of new knowledge about because of telescopes and all kinds volumes and reams of evidence gathered from satellites like the Hubble Space Telescope that confirm the idea that the universe is expanding. And more recently, we've discovered that the rate of expansion is accelerating. The universe is expanding more rapidly than it was in the past. So the universe is not eternal. We know that because it's expanding from a certain point in time. There's another reason why we believe that the universe is not eternal. And this is where Dave talks about science. And this is a scary thing for any scientist out there, and I know that. But as I have read through the literature, and as I've examined the literature, you look at the second law of thermodynamics. I worked real hard on even being able to say that one. Okay, the second law of thermodynamics says that things tend toward disorder over time. Over time, entropy increases, and things tend toward randomness and chaos, which means that if we have an eternally old universe, by now you would have everything in chaos, a state of equilibrium, or as the physicists refer to it, the heat death of the universe. And since what we see today is not an eternally, or not a run-down universe, it's not like a clock that's stopped and wound down, we know that the universe is not eternally old. It started somewhere. So there's all kinds more things you could say about why the universe is not eternally old, but even those two. It's expanding from a finite point in time, and it's not run down yet, is sufficient, I think, to convince us it's not eternally old. How did the universe come into being? Well, it hasn't always existed. Maybe it emerged from nothing. Now, I read this past week on a website published by the Astronomical Society of the Pacific. This is not a fringe group. These are not crazy people. The Astronomical Society of the Pacific is a society, it's the largest astronomical society in the world. It's comprised of amateurs and professionals. It's formed in 1889 in San Francisco. It is a serious group of people. Two guys put together an article in which they write, "If this admittedly speculative hypothesis is correct, then the answer to the ultimate question is that the universe is the ultimate free lunch. It came from nothing. Its total energy is zero, but it nevertheless has incredible structure and complexity." Now, I want you to know that I am not a scientist. I'm not even the son of a scientist. I knew a scientist once, but I'm not a scientist. But what these guys, who are no doubt brilliant people, are asking me to believe, and they're asking you to believe, is something that, from my limited knowledge of science, violates everything science says. And that is that something can come from nothing, and that, in effect, the universe can be greater than its cause. Also, that mass can be created, which violates the first law of thermodynamics, which is the conservation of mass and energy. Nobody is going to seriously maintain that a house or a car just popped into existence. But these two authors and others who hold this position are willing to strain out those gnats and swallow the camel that the whole universe came out of nothing uncaused. So if the universe is not eternal, and if it did not just appear, we're left with one sole alternative. The universe is an effect. What is a cause sufficient to explain the universe? All that we see around us has to be explained by a cause that is outside the universe. A being sufficiently creative to put together all that there is. In short, God. Now, that's not going to overwhelm somebody who is an atheist or perhaps overwhelm even an agnostic, but it's evidence. It's rational, reasonable evidence. And that's not the only evidence we would bring to the table as we're looking for evidence of the existence of God. I want you to consider the Rick Warren argument. You've probably never heard it referred to as this before, but it's the argument that's usually referred to by the word teleology. But in the Greek language, the word telos means end or purpose. So I want you to consider that the world in which we're living is a purpose-driven world. So the Rick Warren argument for the existence of God. Everywhere you look, you find purpose. In every living system, you find purpose. You find, if you take out an iPhone, this is a non-living thing, of course, but take out an iPhone and look at an iPhone, and the technology involved in creating an iPhone is amazing, but it's child's play compared to the complexity of even a one-celled organism like an amoeba or a protozoa. We're still being amazed at all the discoveries we're making about cells and all kinds of living systems and the design of these very complex systems speaks to the need for a designer behind the design. You could look at the nature of man. You could look at who we are as people. We are capable of rational thought. Psychologists as well as theologians today are saying that the functions of our thinking cannot simply be the functions of the physical brain. We're able to have thoughts and deep, rich emotional lives speak of a mind where we wrestle with spirit and truth and beauty. Speaks of a creator beyond the brain. Think of the moral argument. Where does our moral sense come from? Now, obviously, different cultures have different moralities, and there are nuances where some cultures say one thing is moral and some say another is. But every culture that we're aware of has a moral sense. And it's worth arguing that which is behind our sense of morality is God Almighty, who puts this sense of right and wrong within our hearts. Again, there is evidence. There is solid evidence to consider the existence of God. His fingerprints are all over us and all over the creation. To which any of us might say, so what? Is it really important? Is it really important to consider the God question and to think about the existence of God? Or is it just academic? Well, I think it is critically important that every thinking person wrestle with the issue of the existence of God. We can be wrong on some things and suffer only slightly. If you're wrong about where you think the Spurs are going to wind up in the Western Conference, there's very little that you're going to suffer as a result of that. If you're wrong about the weather, you're not going to suffer much. But if a person is wrong about this question, you're going to suffer greatly. A French philosopher who lived in the 17th century, and I've been assured by Gabby Becker that the best way to pronounce his name for a non-French speaker like myself is Blaise Pascal, was trying to convince his friends to take the matter of the existence of God seriously. So he came up with an argument to address their concerns, and his argument has been referred to as Pascal's wager. And Pascal's wager runs like this. If God does not exist and you believe in him, then your life is probably richer for having believed that there is purpose and meaning in life. And if God doesn't exist and you don't believe in him, you've lost nothing. But if God exists and you believe in him, then you have experienced a tremendously abundant life now and in the life to come. If God is real and you don't believe in him, then you have lost not only in this life but also in the life to come. Now, Pascal's wager has been rejected as crass by many people. The thinking is, well, you're saying I should just fake it and kind of hedge my bets on the off chance that maybe there is a God. Of course not. That was never Pascal's thought in the first place. his thought was to convince his friends to take the matter seriously. If there is a God, he's certainly able to see past insincere counterfeit faith. But the issue is exactly as important as Pascal suggests. It is the most significant issue out there. It is the one issue with which every one of us must wrestle. And whether you came in this morning fully convinced that God is, or wondering, I don't know, or fully convinced that God is not, it is my hope that you will begin today an investigation as to the existence of Almighty God. It is the question on which everything else hinges. And that is my hope and prayer for you. And if today begins some spark of interest in exploring this question, and you would like to interact with me about it, I would enjoy nothing more than to talk with you about this most important issue. Now, if you would, I'd like for us to pray.